Taco. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
Segment of our show, Evan Kelly will be telling us a little bit about DDA. So what can you tell me about DDA?
Developmental Disabilities Association. Well, this is it's a fairly long-standing association here in British Columbia. It began in 1952 with a woman by the name of Leola Purdy, who gave birth to a son with Down syndrome. Doctors back in the day would often tell parents to, leave their child in an institution, forget they even had them. And she just said no way. And so she kept them at home and then became the conduit for change in British Columbia. And she would gather 11 or 12 families together at that time to create spaces for people and children with developmental disabilities. So they, by the 60s, they created the first special needs school here in Vancouver. That, of course, led to full inclusion in the 1980s. That's the general start of the whole process, with one woman and one child in 1952. But since then, we've done things like implemented our groundbreaking infant development program, which obviously targets infants with developmental disabilities and early intervention. Picking that back up, an infant development program, which is a program that then spread across Canada and around the world. In fact, the woman who kind of spearheaded that has been awarded the Order of BC. Fast forward 72 years, and we have 50 programs. We have 19 group homes that are 24/7 for people that want to be independent but still need that support. We've got assisted living programs. We've got nine inclusive child care programs in Vancouver and Richmond. I should be clear, we service Vancouver and Richmond proper. And there are other associations in like Burnaby and Delta and other jurisdictions in the Lower Mainland, and most of which are sort of underneath Community Living BC, which is our parent organization. We get a lot of the referrals from Community Living BC. But back to our day programs, we have day programs for teens. We have family support for families who need that support with transitions between teen and adulthood. We've got a wonderful, robust art program, and our DDA artists take part in 8 or 9 art shows every year. We get our clients and residents out into the community all the time. It's really about just helping them reach their potential as Canadian citizens. That's really what it comes down to.
So, what are some of the key benefits for someone with a developmental disability to actually have a presence in the community, to be given that chance at inclusion?
Well, I mean, I think that's just it, inclusion. It's been long determined that getting rid of institutions here in BC, which DDA was a big part of, was instrumental in creating a better community and better results for people with developmental disabilities to be included into the community. They live better lives. They're happier. They live longer. And it's just better for the general public to understand that, differences don't need to drive a wedge between people. That should be celebrated. You know, and that's really the mission of DDA is to make sure that this inclusion happens at every level.
So, in your time with DDA, is there any success moment or story you'd like to share?
Let me just think about that for a second. For me, I mean, because I hadn't worked with people with developmental disabilities before in my previous positions, and you know, getting to know on a personal level some of our clients who I see on a regular basis is really, really nice, and it's really empowering to know that, you know, these people have lives. They have good lives, and they have good lives because of the level of compassion and understanding of the kind of people we hire. You know, we're always that's one of the issues in a caregiving community living agency like ours is finding the right people to do this job. You know, we need more men to get on board, because we have men in our group homes and our assisted living that need that male guidance. And it's a great job, it's a rewarding job, and it's very, very fulfilling. You know, one of the other things that I really like to push a lot since I've been here at DDA is our art program, because the talent and the vision that our artists bring to the table is actually phenomenal. And we have it posted on our website, and they actually sell their works, and the quality is outstanding. It's stuff you want to have in your home, and even just the ability is unbelievable too. We have a sculptor who not only has developmental disabilities, but she's also legally blind, and she's still making sculptures. So it's really inspiring as well.
So, I'm actually very curious about the blind sculptor. Do you use any modified techniques or equipment in supporting her in her art?
That's because I'm not in that space. I don't get to go to our art studio a whole lot. That's a good question. I don't know for certain. I don't really think so. I think she does get some assistance from the instructors, but to what level I can't really say. But she's, you know, she makes these clay fish that you can hang on the wall in sort of a scene, and they're spectacular. They're really, really, really good.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for programs such as yours, what would you say?
Get to know them, you know. Get to know what people with developmental disabilities are like, you know. And it's just, yeah, and the only thing that this community needs is just a little support. They're no different than you and I. And it's just a little support, a little understanding, a little inclusion just goes a long, long way.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Jackie Kimani will be telling us a little bit about Accessible Hope.
So what can you tell me about Accessible Hope?
Yeah, so Accessible Hope International is an organization that's been around for 15 years now, and really our mission is to reach people with disabilities with the holistic gospel. So what that means for us is that we're desiring to see people with disabilities just having an opportunity not only to like hear a message, a Christian message, or to know a Christian message, but really to have their whole lives transformed. So that's physically, emotionally, spiritually, intellectually, economically. Helping them to have a rich and fulfilling life that a lot of people with disabilities are really exempt from right now just because of different things in different societies and places, especially in the global south, where they're cut out from opportunities. So we exist to ensure that people with disabilities have all those opportunities in their lives. Not only for them, but even for any other people with disabilities who would be born after that. Yeah.
So how do you reach out to folks with disabilities to let them know that your work exists?
Yeah, so really we function mainly through like churches and organizations in different places in the world. So we partner with different churches and organizations. And then when we partner with them and they're sensitized to the kind of work that we do, they then let us know where people with disabilities are in their communities. And then now we can be connected to those people with disabilities in that way. Yeah.
So do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning folks with disabilities?
Yeah. We've had some really tough ones, especially in the African context and the South Asian context. We've had some really terrible myths, actually, about people with disabilities. I think one common misconception we have is that, like, people with disabilities have demons or are demon-possessed, or in some contexts, especially in West Africa, they actually just thought to be demons themselves, you know, because maybe they might have a physical disability that prohibits them from walking in a typical way, or they might have seizures, a condition that causes them to have seizures. And when they're having that seizure, then people assume that that's because something supernatural is happening instead of something physiological. And also even just to this relationship with God is often just interesting, right? That people always assume that maybe it's because of a curse from God or curse from demons, or even curse from other family members. That often is said as well, but also just that people with disabilities might even have special abilities, especially supernatural ones. We get that a lot, especially those with intellectual disabilities. They believe they see supernaturally, or they have access to, like, either angels or demons. So there's just a lot of really interesting myths that we've come across, some of them more damaging than others, but all of them often untrue. Yeah.
So in your work with the organization, has there been any success moment that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Sure. So we've been working in Sierra Leone particularly for almost 20 years now. And it's just been really sweet to see women that we work with who've come from a place of just believing very little of themselves, believing that they're really nothing, you know, in many ways, come to a place where they believe that they're humans with dignity made in the image of God. And even beyond that, they start to actually see how God has gifted them with different skills. And then they utilize those skills to actually produce an income for themselves and for their families. I'm thinking of several women, one being a lady named Isachu. She was born with a physical disability that affects both her feet, and her family just didn't think she could amount to much, so she didn't get opportunities to go to school. And they just expected her to just to really beg or be at home. And of course, that really messed up her self-esteem. But when she started coming to our program, she really learned a lot about who God is and who she is, because God made her. She just knew that she was a person made with dignity. So even the way she carried herself, like, started even taking showers, you know, sometimes how you feel about yourself can even come out in that way where you don't even, like, take a bath, you know, but started taking showers, started, like, just keeping herself well. And then we have a fair trade cooperative, and she came just to check it out and realized she's actually very gifted at crafts, and she started making some, and then now she started creating designs, and we're like, wow, I said, those are great, you should sell those, you know. And she's like, really? We're like, yeah. And she started selling some of her stuff, and now she's taken her kids through school. I think she has a child in high school and another one who's going to be in university soon, and it's largely through her work and efforts as she works with her hands, and she's just so brilliant. So it's been so cool to see how the transformation from the inside out has made her a whole different person and has changed not only her life, but even the outcome of the life of her kids.
So in working with folks with disabilities, are there any common concerns that they have about getting into a congregation? How would you support someone who's just new to the idea that they are worth something to God?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have so much, a long way to go regarding just how the church approaches or welcomes people with disabilities, I think, which is why for us, we have this two-tiered ways of doing things where, yes, we work directly with programs that have people with disabilities in them, but we also work with churches to just sensitize them about God's heart for people with disabilities, because we found that sometimes we work with people with disabilities and then they're growing in their dignity and then they try to go to church and then they're kicked out, you know, because the church itself hasn't had a transformed mindset about people with disabilities. So what we do is that we have a theology of disability training where we teach people about God's heart for people with disabilities. And so it's not only one that changes the worldview of people, you know, coming transformation from the inside out, but we also give practical resources and tools about how to welcome people with disabilities. So that's like accessibility to buildings for those in wheelchairs or for those who might need a ramp to just make it easier to get in somewhere, or to have interpretation, or to have accommodations for those who are blind, accommodations so that like services are not too loud for those with some intellectual disabilities where they have sensory issues, you know. So we've really been grateful to God that he's given us both avenues so that we're not only helping people with disabilities to know their need for God and that God loves them and wants relationship with them, but that we're also helping the church to be a place where people with disabilities can come when they learn that the truth about who God is.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee wants to teach you how to be an ally. Listen, be open to learning from the experience of others. Believe, support survivors and those affected by violence. Speak out. Add your voice to call out violence. Intervene. Find a safe way to help when you see acts of gender-based violence. Act. Give your time to organizations working to end violence and be the change you want to see. A message from the Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee at the University of Windsor.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Evan Kelly told us a little bit about DDA, and we heard a little bit about Accessible Hope from Jackie Kamani.
In this segment of our show, Frank Werdinger will be telling us a little bit about Earmark.
So what can you tell me about your work in hearing conservation?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a clinical audiologist, but in hearing conservation, I do a lot of training and education of what we call OHCs, or occupational hearing conservationists. Those are the nurses, medical assistants, in some cases physicians, nurse practitioners, who do all of the hearing testing and training on hearing loss prevention and hearing protection devices for workers who are exposed to occupational noise. So I host 20 to 30 classes a year, teaching them how to be fully credentialing them as occupational hearing conservationists, but also teaching the best practice on how to prevent and protect against noise-induced hearing loss.
So what are some of the key risk factors in an occupational setting?
For noise-induced hearing loss, it's primarily noise, but interestingly enough, it's not limited to noise. There's also chemical exposures called ototoxicants, which are very common in a lot of different workplaces, solvents, paints, different chemicals, things like that, can aggravate your ears' negative response to noise exposure. But since it's noise-induced hearing loss, noise is really the key thing that we're worried about. Noise can come from lots of different sources. It can come from your motors, your tools. It can also come from the air handling and the safety gear that is used around you, such as in mining. You have a lot of different infrastructure that's there to keep you safe, but it also can be rather noisy.
So do you have any advice for folks out there on steps they can take just to reduce their risk and preserve their hearing as best as possible?
Specifically for occupational noise or just in general?
Just in general.
In general. There's three big steps to reduce your risk of hearing injury from noise. And in order they are to turn down a sound, to walk away from a sound, or to wear hearing protection. I'll be happy to go through each one in detail because they apply to different situations.
So, that being said, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about hearing loss?
Every single day. Hearing loss is interesting because it's completely invisible, right? We don't see if a person has hearing loss versus you do see if they have a broken leg, you can see their cast. You do see if a person needs glasses, because you can see their glasses. But hearing loss is completely invisible. It's also invisible to the people who have it because they don't necessarily know what they didn't hear. So a lot of folks don't know about their hearing loss until they've had it for a long period of time, and other people tell them, you are missing things. We don't know what we missed because it just simply wasn't heard. Hearing loss goes undiagnosed, unaware by individuals very often. And another big myth that I want to emphasize is that as a society, we tend to think that hearing loss is inevitable, either because of your loud job or your loud hobbies or because of aging, right? The biggest factor that affects all of our lives. And in truth, it's not inevitable from any of those things. It's preventable from loud work. It's completely avoidable from loud hobbies and preventable in many cases. And aging actually is a much smaller effect on hearing than we sort of give it credit for. As a culture, we tend to say, I just had a worker the other day who was in his 30s, and he said, well, my hearing's normal for my age, right? And unfortunately, it's such a negative connotation and negative mindset, because in truth, age-related hearing loss doesn't really start until of our 70s or 80s or 90s. So these younger folks, people 60s and younger, people working age folks, it is not normal. It's not the case that you should have hearing loss simply because of the years that you've been on this planet.
So, in your work in helping folks conserve their hearing, has there been any success case that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Yeah, so clinically I work a lot with musicians, music population, performing artists, people who work to support the music industry, touring professionals, audio engineers. That's my primary clinical population. And my primary role with them is to help them understand how to mitigate the risks that are all around them in their professional life, but also outside of that. And I've had countless cases where folks have taken hearing loss and hearing risk as an inevitability to their work, right? I play loud rock and roll, I'm going to lose my hearing. Pete Townsend lost his hearing, so I'm going to lose my hearing. I'm trying to pin down to one specific case because there's just been way too many. I had an individual who had what we call temporary threshold shift, which is that feeling that a lot of us have when you go to a concert, you leave the concert, and for the next day or the next couple days, your hearing feels muffled, your ears are ringing, you might have some fullness or sensation in your ears. This is called a temporary threshold shift. He would have this basically every day. Every day after a gig, every day after work, every day after listening to his headphones on a plane to his next gig, listening way too loud. And the only time that he was really free of that would be when he was off of tours. As an audio engineer, he would be off tour for a week or two and would notice that his ears would, as he put it, settle down, right? They would relax after that constant onset. And when we tested his hearing, it was briefly after a tour, and he had a pretty significant hearing loss. We retested him before he went on the next tour, and his hearing was normal again, in the normal range. And we we're able to use that as kind of this moment where he realized, okay, so this is a thing that I'm constantly doing, but it's a thing that I can change. There is an alternative way of going about the work that I do where I am not going to be left with hearing loss permanently. So that guy got lucky, because we could implement hearing protection, change the way that he used in-ear monitors, change the way that he was abusing his ears with loud music in his recreational activities, and avoid a permanent hearing loss, or at least he's avoided it for several years since then. But most people, they don't get that lucky. Those temporary hearing losses, you get that a couple times in a row, and it becomes permanent. Right? You bend a paperclip too many times, it breaks. So in his case, he bent that paperclip enough times, and he was lucky. It's still holding together. It still looks like a paperclip. So his hearing is still stable. So that's a pretty big success.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Thanks. Friends, I'm struck by something Jackie talked about during her interview, the idea that disability is still seen as a curse or a punishment or even a source of divine power. We think of ourselves as being in an enlightened age, where anyone in their uncle can access any bit of information. But the truth of the matter is, that doesn't apply universally. There are places and organizations that still gravitate towards the old-school myths of disability. Take, for example, the stigma surrounding mental health, which frankly astounds me. If you think about it, if we can have compassion for a veteran who has limb damage due to their time in a war, how can we not have compassion or understanding for somebody who's going through just as much, but only we cannot see those scars? Honestly, in a church setting, presence does not mean included. The organization Jackie works with, Accessible Hope, they're doing some great work to make sure the people with disabilities are, in fact, a part of the congregation. There's nothing worse than being alone in a crowd of people. I think we can all relate to that. A time and a place where we sought for acceptance and just didn't find it in the way we hoped. For someone with a disability who goes into a church or religious setting, which by its very definition is something that is supposed to be inclusive, they should find that acceptance, they should find that belonging. But worse still is the question, if they don't, and they're mistreated in any way based on their disability, where are they to go? To whom can they turn? How do they address these concerns? Being someone with a disability who has anything different about them from a mental health or psychological standpoint does not mean they're not entitled to consideration or to have their concerns heard. And, like with anything, a person with a disability is entitled to dignity, an actual answer, not a pablum or assembly line one. One that says, I hear your concerns, and I'm going to be there for and with you to make sure this is taken care of. But it all begins with someone with a disability knowing their rights, knowing their value. And one of those key rights, by definition, is simply the right to be included, the right to be heard. Just because you have a disability does not make you less of a person, does not make you less entitled to being considered or to being valued. And any organization working to alleviate these myths and stereotypes, they have my full support. They have a great body of work that they're doing. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Hello, this is Rob Rebel Radio, recorded on Friday, September 12th, 2025. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca